Hi, Norman Solomon. Welcome again to Cable.
Hey, thanks very much. Good to be with you.
Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole. I'm talking to Norman Solomon, a Cable alumnus, went on to become an author of 12 books. He's a syndicated columnist, also an activist and movement builder. He founded the Institute for Public Accuracy. He's affiliated with FAIR, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, and founded the organization Roots Action that mobilizes, demonstrates, educates, writes letters, and many other things behind policies that actually address the immense economic, social, racial, and environmental problems facing our country. Norman Solomon ran for Congress in 2012, narrowly lost in the open primary. He was a Bernie Sanders delegate at both the last two Democratic National Conventions and coordinated the Independent Bernie Delegates Network in his efforts to win the nomination in 2016 to defeat Hillary Clinton. Unfortunately, Sanders did not. And throughout it all, he wrote articles and op-eds. Indeed, has one in the magazine, The Nation, with Daniel Ellsberg. The title is To Avoid Armageddon, Don't Modernize Missiles, Eliminate Them. So, Norman, we're seeing a struggle for the soul of the Democratic Party. The old guard is being challenged, and newbies, the progressives, are not afraid to discuss nationalization, for example, of the energy industry. That's one example. Also, strong support for labor unions, Black Lives Matter, meaningful democratization of decision-making across the society, and also deep cuts in the military budget. Norman Solomon, tell us about the rise of the Progressive Caucus. Then we can get to Build Back Better and the other sweeping Biden administration initiatives now being cut back, but still important. First, Norman, the Progressive Caucus.
Well, Bill, it's good to be with you, and I really appreciate that for so many years on the Old Mole, you've been providing perspectives and information to KBOO listeners. If you go back, say, a dozen years, the Progressive Caucus in the House of Representatives was an effort, but not a very effective effort, to galvanize the support of progressives inside the Democratic Party, inside Congress. And the leadership was, well, not the greatest. It was making a lot of assertions of power, but when push came to shove, it would really fold. And that certainly happened on health care during the very beginning of the Obama administration. You had, for instance, a promise from the top of the Progressive Caucus that they would not vote on the floor for any measure that didn't include at least a public option, which wasn't all the way to single-payer Medicare for all, but would have a sort of nonprofit government health care insurance plan made available in the mix of these exchanges that states would provide. But then when push came to shove, the leadership of the Progressive Caucus back then in 2009 basically collapsed its claim of being stalwart and just gave in. So the long story short, Bill, I think we could say that for many years, the Progressive Caucus in Congress developed a reputation for, hey, we will talk big, but we can be rolled. We can really fold. That has, to a large extent, changed. And let's acknowledge that progressives in Congress, including the squad, people like Rashida Tlaib, Ilhan Omar, now Jamal Bowman, AOC, they're in a tough spot. And it's going to be difficult in the days ahead to navigate the situation where you have Senators Sinema and Manchin chipping away at what needs to be a very large bill to revitalize public investment from the U.S. government, pulled down from $6 trillion down as we speak to about $2 trillion in the intra-Congress negotiations. But that said, to get back to your question, the Congressional Progressive Caucus has taken to this moment a much stronger position, and it's given progressives more power in Congress as a result.
Yeah, my sense was that the big difference, in fact, the moment that the Progressive Caucus began to really enlarge and be able to assert power, it's with the Bernie Sanders campaign showing that such a great number of people within the party, and particularly in many, many districts, support really progressive legislation. And I think noting that there was an electoral surge by many progressives, and the outcome now is obvious.
That's been important. And when you can show that you can win elections from the grassroots, that's crucial. You know, when Cori Bush in St. Louis area ousted a longtime sort of mushy liberal, that was important. When Jamal Bowman ousted Elliot Engel in the Bronx area and beyond in New York City, that was important as well. It's really sent a message that progressives can win elections. We usually don't if it's very strong progressives, but it can happen. And it can challenge people who are in Congress, have been there a while. Maybe they answer to the label liberal. Maybe they call themselves progressive. And so that gives more leverage. I should say that when we're talking about Oregon, the worst member of Congress with a Democrat is Kurt Schrader. And I know that many of our listeners live in Schrader's district. If you go down, I believe, to Clackamas County and out towards the coast, Kurt Schrader's a terrible corporate Democrat. He's been one of the worst in the House. And these are the kind of people who have to be defeated in primaries by genuine progressives who can run strong campaigns, not impulse campaigns like you grab a candy bar on the way out of the checkout stand at the supermarket, but well-planned campaigns that take literally years or at least a full year to plan and execute before the election. And that ability of progressives to do serious electoral work, whether we're talking about local races, state legislature, Multnomah County, whatever it might be, this is very important because it is a building block to exerting pressure at all levels of government for progressive purposes.
Yeah, one thing that I want to add, though, and I know you agree with, one of the best members of Congress also comes from Oregon, Jeff Merkley. That brings us to the great sweep of Biden's initiatives. They've been whittled down, less money, but not to nothing. It seems to me that the Biden administration's proposals, including especially the climate action proposals, as a totality, they can be seen as an agenda for action, if not in this Congress, but soon. What's your sense?
Well, we have some awful members of Congress who have a D after their name, Joe Manchin from West Virginia and Kyrsten Sinema from Arizona, both senators being notorious ones. We also have a progressive push, and we have some members of Congress that will blow with the wind. And as you say, I think the Green New Deal, which is still largely aspirational under that title, has been very important, and it came from the grassroots. As usual, the most important drastic reforms and paradigm-changing proposals come from the grassroots. They come from states. They come from localities where people raise hell with their elected representatives and organize outside the electoral system as well as inside of it to make change. And there was a big moment right after AOC was elected, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and we're talking now close to 3 years ago, when there was a sit-in by the Sunrise Movement in Nancy Pelosi's office, the Speaker of the House in D.C., and AOC went to that sit-in to give verbal support, and that was symbolically important, and politics is, in part, symbols, and it helped put on the agenda and the discourse, and people such as Bernie Sanders in Congress and people whose names we don't know around this country fought to make sure that the concept of a Green New Deal would be put forward. I know it came from the grassroots. I can mention that in 2010, 2 years before my congressional campaign ended in the primary election, I was co-chair of a Green New Deal commission that was totally not part of any governmental entity, but in Northern California, in Marin and Sonoma counties, we held a bunch of independent hearings, 8 or 10 of them, about what we called a Green New Deal. We weren't the first, but we were part of that process. And so my point, Bill, is that when people bring up ideas, commitments, principles, aspirations, determination that are not taken seriously in Washington, D.C., in official circles, we might be blown off for a long time, but that's how change happens.
My sense is, Norman, that though the early initiatives, Build Better Back, family job program, family support programs, all of them are being whittled On the other side, though, and the real test of the Biden administration is what they do with the existing budgets of the Energy Department, of the military, of Medicare and Medicaid, how they direct those departments. The Energy Department, for example, has huge sums of money, huge $20-30 billion, whatever it is, that they invest in research, and they can do research into carbon sequestration, or they can do research into small-scale experiments, and not just experiments now, all over the country. Municipalities are moving into providing energy, and there's a large sector of public utilities. They can really support those programs. And across the board, in terms of community college tuition help and so many other programs, even the mutilated public assistance program can, and childcare programs can be, in fact, made far more effective. What do you see as, Norman, the American Prospect did those, that series on what Biden could do even without legislation. It seems to me that we have to keep pushing, and the progressive caucus can't push them, no matter how far, whatever compromises have to be made to, in fact, transform policy of some of the existing agencies.
Well, in terms of the Department of Energy, I mean, it's a notorious agency for people paying attention. It's responsible for the nuclear weapons production complex, and it's done terrible things from Hanford, of course, on the Columbia River to many other facilities. My understanding, and I'm not an expert of it, but carbon sequestration is, a scam, a waste of money. It sounded good a few years ago. What we really need to do is cut back on methane, and especially, of course, fossil fuels. It has to be drastic. And again, we have Joe Manchin in the Senate, unfortunately, a senator from coal, who's really been holding up progress. There has, as you allude to, been a lot of conceptual step forwards from Democrats in Congress who are feeling the pressure. I mean, the Republican Party is a complete and utter disaster. There's not one good thing you can say about it. It has become in many ways neo-fascistic, and the Democrats have been overall moving in a good direction. If, however, for instance, as you said, military budget is one of the tests for the Biden administration, it has completely failed. It has completely flunked. It has continued to raise the military budget. I don't say defense budget, certainly not lowercase d defense. Biden came in asking for a 1.6 increase in an already tremendously bloated, huge military budget, and Democrats pretty much doubled that increase amount, and Republicans were pushing it, and Democrats also went with it. So this is a disaster, the military-industrial complex. Well, you go to Portland or Salem or Vancouver or any cities in the Northwest or around the country, and I probably don't need to tell listeners who are in Portland or elsewhere what is happening to urban areas and rural areas, the lack of infrastructure. I do think that Biden, especially early on with the $6 billion, even with $6 trillion over 10 years, a yearly ratio, half of military spending, but the 10-year, $6 trillion overall bill that's been, as you said, whittled down, this is very important. It would have been extremely valuable at $6 trillion, very valuable at $3.5. We're going to take what we can get, so to speak, but this is inadequate, but it's a step, an important step in public investment in a good direction.
Norman, to conclude, you're a writer, an activist. You get into the struggles in Congress. Right now, Roots Action, that you founded, is fighting to stop the confirmation of Rahm Emanuel to be ambassador to Japan. What's the story?
It's an important story, and it deserves more attention than it has been getting overall. The fact is that Rahm Emanuel is one of the most corporate, viciously corporate operatives in the Democratic Party. He was head of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. He was in Congress for a few years. He was mayor of Chicago for 8 years, in which time he oversaw shutting 50 public schools, mostly in racially minority neighborhoods. shut a dozen or so, as I recall, mental health facilities. He was running an administration that covered up the police murder of 17-year-old Laquan McDonald, a young African-American man. Notoriously, that administration suppressed the video showing that police murder for 13 months until after Rahm Emanuel was reelected at a very close race. And Rahm Emanuel has now been nominated by President Biden to be the U.S. ambassador to Japan, which is the third largest economy on the planet. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee just a couple of weeks ago held its hearing with Rahm Emanuel whether to approve his nomination to be ambassador to Japan. And only one senator out of a couple of dozen on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee had the gumption and really the courage to speak directly with tough questions to Rahm Emanuel about his administration as mayor in Chicago overseeing the cover-up of the police murder of Laquan McDonald. And that senator was Oregon's Jeff Merkley. And the takeaway is first that Merkley was very strong and really brave politically to do that. And you had other people on that Senate Foreign Relations Committee who took a dive. As a matter of fact, Ed Markey from Massachusetts didn't even show up. Cory Booker from New Jersey didn't even show up. These were people who voted for the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act last year, but they didn't even show up because they didn't want to be in the uncomfortable position of either questioning in any intelligent, tough way Rahm Emanuel or basically showing their silence by being there and not being willing to confront. So I guess what I would emphasize at this point is that any day now, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee is going to vote on the nomination, and then the vote will go to the full Senate floor. And I would urge people to contact Senator Jeff Merkley, if you live in Oregon, and contact via email or telephone Jeff Merkley's office. Praise him for being a senator willing to ask tough questions of Rahm Emanuel, and urge him to announce that he's going to vote no on the nomination.
Norman Solomon, we're out of time. Thanks a lot. Keep up the good work.
You too. Thanks, Bill.
So long.